Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And as President Donald Trump starts his second term in office, some of his supporters are already pushing for a constitutional amendment to allow him to have a third term. In this episode, we examine how constitutional amendments are ratified, and we also examine other ways Trump might demand another term in office. Judge Gail, this idea for this program came to you from a listener, did it not?
It did, actually, because of the very concern that you raised. And I realized just from that exchange that if this person felt like this, that there are probably a lot more listeners out there that are wondering, how likely is this? Can this really happen? And what do we do if the wheels start rolling, or what do we do if this becomes an eventuality? So I think it's a really timely topic, and I'm so hopeful that those who are questioning what the process is, I hope that you are better equipped to understand it so that you can continue to engage your government in the ways that you see fit, especially if there's a certain outcome on the horizon that you may not be really in favor of.
Well, let's jump into the presidential term issue, and let's set it up for folks. Right now, the 22nd Amendment, and we have 27, the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution currently bars anyone from being elected to more than two terms as president, whether they're consecutive or not. This was passed as a result of Franklin Delano Roosevelt having three terms, and he was elected to his third term, 1940 to 1944, but died during that term. And the American public and government officials said, that's enough. Two terms. You know, it was stretching it. We knew there was depression in World War II, but it was still stretching it. We were going to limit it to two terms. Well, now that President Trump is in office and a lot of people are enamored by him and his presidency, a representative from Tennessee, a congressman named Andy Ogles, O-G-L-E-S, has introduced a measure into the House of Representatives allowing more than two terms. In other words, getting rid of the 22nd Amendment and allowing Trump to be potentially elected for a third term. He had a quote on the introduction of this saying, Trump has proven himself to be the only figure in modern history capable of reversing our nation's decay and restoring America to greatness. He must be given the time necessary to accomplish that goal. Well, that's been introduced into the House, but passing a constitutional amendment, as Judge Gail and I will go through with you, is a little more complicated than just passing a resolution or passing something through Congress. Judge, we can only look at the Equal Rights Amendment, which was to give equal rights to women. One would think that that would be innocuous enough, but it's been out there for years and years and years. there's a debate as to whether or not it's ever finally passed, but there are many different processes to go through before we get a constitutional amendment.
You are so right. Can we kind of start, though? I'm chuckling because I'm thinking about the language of the proposal from Congressman Ogles, who talks about how the president has already proven himself
already.
Already. And I'm just thinking, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Wasn't the inauguration just barely a few weeks ago? Not even a month ago. We are not a month into this. And so I don't know anyone who believes, 2 weeks on the job is proof of anything, but here we are.
Let me go one step further. And I did not mention this, but Ogle's resolution is tailored, the language in it is tailored to permit Trump to serve a third term, but not to allow the 3 out of 4 living presidents to serve third term. So it keeps Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama from serving additional terms, but would allow President Trump to serve an additional term.
Only.
He says it's imperative that we provide President Trump with every resource necessary to correct the disastrous course set by the Biden administration. He's dedicated to restoring the republic and saving our country, and we as legislators and as states must do everything in our power to support him. I'm proposing the amendment to the Constitution to revise the limitations imposed by the 22nd Amendment on presidential terms.
And again, specifically for this one, and not for anyone else.
Not for George W. Bush, and I never thought I'd welcome him back, but I would.
I actually might welcome him back.
I would right now. I'd welcome back Dick Cheney and George W. Bush.
Given the circumstances.
Neither of whom were my favorites at the time, but I'd welcome him back in a heartbeat.
Oh, my goodness. It's just, again, it's amazing. So what I'd like to do is I want to kind of start with kind of the background, and I want to invite you to kind of fill in the process as we go for our listeners.
Absolutely.
Because what we want you to understand is that, although, this is the perspective of the representative, as you said, Judge, it is not an easy process. It is not like you, reach over, you flip a switch, and all of a sudden the lights come on or the lights go off. It is not that. The authority to amend the United States Constitution is actually derived out of Article 5 of the United States Constitution. And so, as has happened here with a member of Congress proposing the amendment, which it can start with the proposal of an amendment, or it can from a member of Congress, or it can start out of the states. But we're just going to stick right now with the idea because these are the facts that we have so far.
Right.
After we have a member of Congress that proposes the amendment, then what happens is it then triggers the archivist of the United States, who heads the National Archives and the Records Administration.
By the way, that person was changed out by Trump because of the confidential and classified documents case at Mar-a-Lago.
No surprise there.
So we have a new archivist, but go ahead.
We now have a new national archivist, and it's called the NARA. So the National Archives and Records Administration, or NARA, or N-A-R-A. It then triggers the head of the National Archives and Records Administration to begin a process, because that individual then becomes charged with the responsibility of administering this ratification process. And that's also pursuant to federal law. It's found in 1 USC 106B, like boy. And you're welcome to
USC is United States Code for those correct. People out there who don't know. We in legal jargon abbreviate it to USC.
we abbreviate as much as we can. And when we don't abbreviate, we then use words that have foreign derivation so that in so much that some
And obtuse meanings.
Yeah. And they don't understand it. Sometimes the people who use the words don't understand it. So you're right. It's found in the United States Code, which is the code of laws for the United States. Now, you may notice in your state and in your community, your state has laws, and maybe your locality has laws or statutes. And so the United States also has the same thing, which is what you said, judges, the USC or the United States Code. And so under this specific section of the United States Code, the archivists or the National Archivists, who we now have a new one, I couldn't tell you who they are, they're given the responsibility to kind of work through these, what we would consider ministerial duties that's, you know, associated with these functions, as well as whatever, as well as working with the director of the Federal Register. Now, it's important to understand that Article 5 of the Constitution, nor in the specific section of the U.S. Code that I just explained to you, 1 U.S.C. 106B, neither of these really outline the specific process for ratification in detail. Now, what they do then, they do set out that there is a process, but the specificity of it is actually kind of vague. And so what happens is the National Archivist, along with the director of the Federal Register, then rely on what are known as procedures or customs that have previously been established in determining exactly the process for fulfilling the obligations under Article 5. And so this has been going on since 1950, consistent with what you said, Judge, and they also work with whomever the administrator is of General Services. It should be noted that all of these individuals I've just pointed out are obviously in the executive branch and therefore can be and have been appointed by the administration, the current administration.
By the president, that's right.
And so you can suspect, and probably rightfully so, that there are going to be certain allegiances in place that are now going to guide this process, or could guide this process through. And mind you,
although one would think that an archivist would not have a political bent in this day and age, I'm not betting on it.
Correct. And so back to our point of how we got here, what our Constitution provides for, it provides for an amendment that can be proposed either by Congress, hence Congressman Ogles here, but it's required to have a two-thirds majority vote, and not just the House of Representatives, where, yes, there is indeed a Republican majority, but there is not a Republican supermajority. So remember, the margins in the House of Representatives is very, 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 very close.
Four votes, if I'm not
four votes, that. And you know, and that can change at any time. But you need a two-thirds majority in the House of Representatives. And you also need the same two-thirds majority vote in favor of this amendment in the Senate. And again, even though there are Republican majorities in both the House and the Senate, it doesn't take much to consider the fact that even with these majorities, in the majority in the Senate is a little bit more than what it is in the House. I think it's by four seats. You still don't have two-thirds. So it would require Democratic support in order to get over the two-thirds line. Go ahead, Judge.
Let me jump in there, because to get over a filibuster, it's 60 votes, correct?
Correct.
To eliminate a filibuster. This would be even more than the vote to eliminate a filibuster. This would be two-thirds. 100 senators, so we're talking about 66 or 67 senators. So it's even greater vote than it would be to eliminate a filibuster.
Correct. We can't even get 60 to eliminate the filibuster. So if you think there's a struggle to get the filibuster eliminated, then again, consider the fact that you need what is considered well in excess of that to get to the two-thirds limit that you would need. And again, both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. Now, remember also, if we go back to the House of Representatives, not only is the majority slim, but you also have a lot of infighting even amongst Republicans. You have some Republicans in the House of Representatives who are representing strong Democratic areas. And so whether or not that makes it likely that they would support something like this, again, we're talking politics, not law. It makes it fairly unlikely that those members of Congress would be supportive. But just for the sake of understanding process, this is what's necessary, is that two-thirds votes in both sides. Or you need what's called a constitutional convention that's called by two-thirds of the state legislatures. And so that, I think, also would be a bit of a challenge. If you want to jump in here, Judge, and talk about that?
Yeah, there are two convention processes. One is something introduced by Congress, and we've talked about that. And the other one is for the state legislators and state legislatures to, by a two-thirds majority, ask for a constitutional convention. A constitutional convention, like they had originally when they established the Constitution, would be looking at amending the Constitution. Now, this has never happened. It's never happened. The 27 amendments to the Constitution of the United States have not ever come out of a constitutional convention. But my concern, Judge Gale, on this is if there would be a constitutional convention, if there would be, it is free-flowing free-for-all in the sense that we're not talking about just this amendment. It would be that convention could look at any amendment, change any amendment, add any amendment.
Repeal.
So it could repeal amendment. The First Amendment. It could repeal the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment. All of these vital amendments, the Fifth Amendment, all of these vital amendments that we have relied on since the inception of our country could be in jeopardy if there were a constitutional convention. So even though it's far-fetched, even though it hasn't been done in the past, if it were done, it could be catastrophic to our Constitution.
You are so very right. And you're also right to point out that we've never seen this process happen with a constitutional convention. And so aside from the uniqueness of that, it could absolutely spiral into what we have consistently said before, the constitutional crisis that we believe we're facing now. It could be just made exponentially worse or exacerbated with the constitutional convention. Now, and I also want to note, you know, given the lifespan of the United States Constitution, it being, you know, several centuries old, the fact of the matter is that obviously we take amending or changing the Constitution very seriously, because it's only happened 27 times successfully. And so, and again, in each and every instance, it has happened because of congressional proposal and not because of the constitutional convention. But it also speaks to the fact that we don't seemingly engage this behavior without the requisite thoughtfulness and without really, really considering it. Because again, it's only been done 27 times. And with that being the case, and with, you know, Congress playing presumably an outsized role in this, Congress would propose the amendment in the form of what's called a joint resolution. So it would not come as just, you know, the mere proposal that Congressman Ogles has put forward, but in order for it to be formally proposed, it would have to come as that joint resolution. And because the president himself does not have a constitutional role. He does not have any role actually in this process. And
if it's passed, it does not go to the president for signature.
Absolutely not.
Because the president has, as you mentioned, has absolutely no role in this.
He does not. And I know he would, you know, this president at least would probably desire to and would, you know, like to, if nothing else, play maybe puppet master, but he does not have a constitutional role in this process. It is truly, when it's brought by Congress, it is truly kind of guided and governed by Congress. And so you're right. There's no requirement where we usually see Congress, both chambers, passing legislation. And we often talk about the idea that now it has to go to the president's desk for signature so that it can become law. That is not the case here. And it doesn't require that because essentially once it's done, it's done. In fact, once that process takes place, whatever the original documents are then forwarded to the archivist office of the Federal Register for processing and publication. So that's how the rest of us are, you know, supposed to be made aware that this change has made. And you're right, Judge, if there is a constitutional convention and there could be all kinds of changes that were never originally contemplated or intended, but could come out of this. And many of us could, I would hope that we'd have our ears to the ground, but in the event that you don't, you would find out about this through the publication process in the Federal Register. Okay. It gives the legislative history. The Federal Registry does. It provides the legislative history of it, and as well as the joint resolution, and it publishes it, you know, in a format for, again, the public that's impacted by it, so for us to see it and to know it, and to always and to be able to appreciate it.
Let me jump in here because before we leave the Constitutional Convention. Because Trump carried 38 of the 50 states, he's carried 30 of the 50 states in 2024. It would not be an unknown figure, given the pressures that they put on states and the control that they have. The Trump administration has over state legislators across the country, it would not be unheard of to get to the number required for a constitutional convention. So let's say that the bill, before we take the bill, the resolution on forward, let's say that it can't get to the two-thirds vote in the House and the Senate for passage. You know, the supporters of that bill and the Trumpites could very easily start putting pressure on the states to call a state, to call a national constitutional convention. So I would not write that off our sort of checklist to watch in the future. I think that's very possible.
Well, and if you count the states that were won in this last election cycle, two-thirds of 50 is 33. So there, you know, are three more states that would need to essentially be identified and picked off.
Yeah. So just think of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a real possibility because I doubt, let's be honest, I doubt that this will pass the House and the Senate. You know, I don't see Democrats going for it. And so it's unlikely. So there's got to be a plan B if they're really, truly serious about this. And if
Indeed.
Trump really wants a third term, and that would be to go to the Constitutional Convention. So I didn't mean to interrupt the flow, but I don't think we can dismiss that as a possibility.
No, I think you're absolutely spot on. And I think it would be foolhardy to completely dismiss it either because it's never happened before, because it's, you know, extremely unique, because the process.
God knows we're having everything that's never happened before.
Right? Right? Or because that would be a process we're not terribly familiar with. But You're absolutely right. We would, I think, be operating with kind of blinders on if there's no real appreciation for the fact that this is, no matter how remote the possibility is, it is still a possibility.
And just think what that could mean, not only to the First Amendment, not only to Trump being president for God knows how long, but also, you know, it would apply to church and state. You know, we've got Christian nationalists throughout the government now who would be promoting a change in the language of the Constitution, you know, about the separation of church and state. You know, so everything would be fair game, and it would be an entirely different document and an entirely different country.
And remember, we are not even 1 month into this administration.
About 3 weeks, aren't we?
Barely 3 weeks. And although we've certainly seen some things kind of work at warp speed and move pretty fast, I think there's also something to be said for a very methodical approach to something this considerable. And something this large, I certainly could imagine how it would resonate around the globe, the impact of something of this nature, and continue to impact, you know, just right here in our own backyards, in our own nation, our own country. I think the effect and impact would be quite considerable. Now, what I don't want to do is I don't want our listeners to believe that after this process kind of moves the way it does in both chambers of the House of Representatives, that means that the states have no input, no obligation. Just because there's no constitutional convention does not mean that the states themselves are not, do not have a role. That is not correct, because once the documents have been assembled and they have been properly redlined and they've been published, then what happens is the resolution itself is provided to the states, and they are also provided what the process would be or the procedure for ratifying under the United States Code. And so it's the job of the archivist to submit whatever the proposed amendment is to the respective states. So that would be all 50 states, not just the 30 or 33 that, you know, otherwise could have come together to form the Constitutional Convention, but all 50 states then receive.
Maybe not just 51 if we add Canada.
Or 52 if we add, you know, Mexico.
Greenland,
52. And meanwhile, Puerto Rico's been waiting for a while.
Yeah, right.
Go right ahead.
But, as has the District of Columbia. So go for it.
Yes, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, you know.
Yeah.
The list goes on. The list goes Northern Mariana Islands, Guam, you know, all these folks. That said, though, we could have 50 states. And again, as you said, you know, a constitutional convention could actually put all of this on the table. It could be all of these things that then get addressed or impacted, and it could be really scary. But that said, that's when the archivist is responsible for packaging this resolution and providing the proposed amendment to the various states, and like I said, all 50 states, and the states are then to consider the resolution. And this is done by first providing notification to the state's governors. And there's, again, this process where the governor receives the resolution, they receive the red line version, and this information having been prepared by the federal government, the governors then formally submit the amendments to their state legislatures. And the state calls for the convention depending on what Congress has specified in the past. Now, I'm going to pause this and say, consider all of the states that have either majorities or supermajorities of one party or another. Consider the states that have very slim majorities and what, again, the outcome could be based on these. And so when we are, I think, telling our listeners that your vote counts, your vote matters, and that what may feel like, you know, light years away by the actions of the federal government have no real effect or impact on you at home or in your own backyard, this is absolutely one of those ways when your vote on who represents you at your state house, who represents you in your state government, can really truly affect your life on the federal level.
It's interesting, I think, that according to the Constitution, it takes a two-thirds vote to pass the resolution by Congress. It then would take a two-thirds vote of the states to have a state constitutional convention. But when you get to the states, it ups it to three-quarters, right?
Correct.
Three quarters to pass it, three quarters to pass it by the Congress and three quarters to pass it by the states.
Three fourths, which from the 50 states now is 38 out of 50 states.
Right.
If we stick with 50.
Yeah, that's right.
You can pad the numbers.
States have two ways of doing it. Mm-hmm. The states can choose, and again, that becomes a political decision.
Yeah, why don't you talk a bit about that?
Well, the states have two ways of doing it. The governor can transmit this to a state legislature, and if three-fourths of the legislators approve the amendment, then it goes back to the federal government as approved by that state. However, the other possibility is not to put it in the legislature's hands, but instead have a state convention to examine the proposed amendment. And again, then three-quarters of the appropriate convention delegates must approve the amendment, and if they do, it would go back to the federal government. You know, the interesting thing on this is once it goes to the states, you can imagine by what we've described, it becomes a bit cumbersome, and state legislatures meet at various different times across the country. Some only meet once a year, some meet less frequently than that, some meet continually. So there's a time frame here. And one might ask, is there a particular set time period that the states have to act? Congress has passed this, it's gone to the states, the states have to ratify or disapprove. Is there a time period? And the answer to that is no, not really. The Supreme Court has said that ratification must be done within a reasonable time after the proposal, but they don't say what a reasonable time is. So this process is not a quick process, and we have states, some may choose a convention, some may choose to have their legislature take action on it. But just look at the history of the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment for Women. It languished in the states for decades before there was action by some states. So it's a long, protracted process.
And I think it's intended that way to make sure that whatever changes we're making to this living document, this Constitution, are thoughtful. It's intended that we would, you know, make these changes, but we'd also live with them forever, just like we live with the Constitution itself and the language of it and the body of it. And we've let it be our guiding star that any changes we make should not be done kind of knee-jerk or too easily, but rather they should be changes that are done that we as a nation are comfortable with living with, again, for the long term and not backtracking on those. But it also invites another question based on what you said, Judge, about the two processes that can take place once the resolutions reach the states. Is there any opportunity for the citizens, the electorate, those folks in the states directly impacted by these proposed changes, is there any opportunity for them to vote on whether or not their state should ratify or adopt these changes, directly voting, or is it limited to a delegation process?
It's limited to the convention and to the state legislature. You know, now, I assume that there could be some kind of popular vote to guide those entities, but a popular vote's not going to do it. You know, it's pretty limited.
And it sounds like, so, and I asked that on purpose to help manage the expectations of the electorate, because again, you may expect that as a regular random citizen for something this large to happen, to invite this kind of change, that certainly, most assuredly, the government will invite your voice to be heard through a vote, and that is not what happens.
Well, let me jump in here. Your voice can still be heard in lobbying delegates to a convention or lobbying state legislators. That has happened routinely, and it really happened on the Equal Rights Amendment. There were all kinds of groups that were lobbying to get states to pass that. So there is some input, but it's not ballot box input. Now, you compare that to a lot of states. Ohio is an example where it seems like almost routinely Ohio has a constitutional amendment on the state ballot to either change abortion laws or to change drug laws in relationship to marijuana, just as a couple of examples. But and in fact, the Republicans put one on to make it a 60% majority to pass any kind of amendment, and that failed. So there are all kinds of constitutional amendments where people can vote directly, but that's on state issues. That's not amending the federal constitution, which is an entirely different process.
And it's so interesting that you say that, because you're so right. And in my home state and your home state of former home state of Ohio, there are frequently constitutional amendments that are put
forward.
Seems
like all the time. Yeah.
And I think, you know, we'll probably look forward to more in the future related to various issues. I think just the other day, there was a call for a constitutional amendment for common sense gun laws when, you know, allegedly an individual who's blind was granted a permit to carry a concealed weapon. And so that is, you know, an example of maybe one of the things we can look forward to seeing will be brought up as an amendment to the to our Ohio Constitution. But as you said, has no effect or impact on the state constitution. And instead, your direct involvement as a citizen, if this process were undertaken, would not be to go to your ballot box. You will not see this as a issue or a matter to vote upon on your ballot. But you do still maintain the power to engage enough to the point where you know who the potential delegates are that will be making these decisions on behalf of your state. And so you could absolutely lobby, talk to, call, work to influence those delegates and their votes so that those votes align with whatever the will of the people, the populace of the people are. And from there, you can expect certain outcomes. In states that are, you know, purple, you could probably expect there to be, you know, a little more of a diverse opinion. But states that have been traditionally, you know, Republican or red or Democrat for blue, you can probably anticipate what the voting outcome is going to be by any delegates that go to the convention for those states. And it's important because, as we said before, under this process, now as it proceeds to the state, the requirement is going to be, assuming there's only going to be 50 states, or there would be 50 states at the time, the requirement was that there would be 38 states that ultimately send formalized, finalized ratifications back to the archivist, indicating that their state, the state has in fact ratified it. That also speaks to, again, the fact that it is not required that all 50 states agree to a constitutional amendment or a change. There are thresholds that will be met, but you will likely not get 100% of anything from anybody on any particular topic. And the same holds true here. But again, for this to be successful, the proposed amendment must be ratified by 3/4 of the states, which is 38 of the 50 states. And once that is verified, then there is a process that takes place where the archivist certifies that the amendment is valid and that now it has become part of the United States or the federal constitution, which I cannot underscore enough. We've only done this successfully 27 times. And, you know, and it goes back to your point, Judge Tom, about what a reasonable period of time is for the states to actually do this and make this happen. Well, consider our current circumstance with wildfires in California. It is entirely possible that the California legislature may delay in convening because of wildfires or some other natural disasters. If it were hurricane season in Florida or some of, you know, the southern states that are affected, then you could expect that there may be delays in convening those legislatures. So, you know, reasonable period of time is really relative based on, you know, what that state's procedure is and any other factors that might affect or impact their ability or inability to convene, such that you may or may not get to the 38, the number 38 that you need in order to ratify a constitutional amendment, which would make all the, you know, work and voting of the House of Representatives and the Senate for naught. And the same would hold true for any other state that has held its convention and also submitted ratification documents if you never get to the number 38.
It's interesting, though, if the states would adopt a proposed amendment and it goes back to the archivist, then the president becomes involved, even albeit in a ceremonial way. There is usually some pomp and circumstance and flourish for the president to sign off on this document amending the Constitution, and we've had a history of that. Johnson signed certifications for the 24th and 25th Amendment. President Nixon signed a certification for the 26th Amendment, and there, you know, the 27th Amendment, the archivist performed the duties. So it's not an official presidential duty, but the president could get involved. Now, let me jump in here with the politics of this. We've pretty well covered the law of this, but the politics of this is, what role does a president take in advancing an amendment, either through any of the means that we've talked about? And in the past, some presidents have been actively involved. Some presidents have not been that actively involved. The Equal Rights Amendment went through several presidents and several different types of involvement or lack thereof. You know, could Trump take this on as a political cause and rally the country to do this? That's a question, I think, that regardless of the process, and it's important to look at the process, and we have done that, but could he master this politically to get this done? That's the question, I think, that we really have to ask ourselves.
And I think if we are talking about could as in capabilities or interest or, you know, desire, I think that we would be very foolish to dismiss it for a myriad of reasons. But at the same time, I think that even without an amendment to the United States Constitution, which is we've now described as a very, very high bar. I think that there's an awful lot that can be done over the course of the next 4 years that will make it exceptionally, may or could make it exceptionally difficult to recognize this country from, I don't know, in comparison to even, you know, 7 or 10 years ago, or maybe 3 or 5 years ago. And so even without the constitutional amendment, which I do believe that, yes, to the answer to your direct question is, I think absolutely, yes, there could be lots of lobbying. There could be lots of pressure. There could be a considerable amount of interest placed on this. And I think, again, given the warp speed with which we've seen things move most recently, I think even if we were, you know, 2 to 2.5 or maybe even 3 years into this administration, we should not take this this concept, this idea, and kind of shelve it and pretend that it doesn't exist or it's remote. Because I think the closer you may get to the end or the conclusion of this term, then it may become all the more imminent, or it may become all the more interesting, or perhaps all the more important that the efforts to ramp it up are realized. And that's when you may see more obvious efforts. I think planting the seed now is very interesting because you have 3+ years, almost 4 years worth of runway to work on a campaign, if you will, that continuously builds on this and continues to bring this about. And also, if you are leveraging other levers of government to accomplish certain things. For example, if you are looking to choke off financial resources to certain states, unless or until they comply or bend to a certain will, it could in fact result in those same states and those same state legislatures deciding that this is perhaps the best way to go in order to return to normalcy. And so if in exchange for ratifying a constitutional amendment, we'll have the restoration of resources back to our state, then, you know, we can live with it for another 4 years, maybe. There's any number of things that I could imagine potentially being kind of the I won't even say carrot and stick, it's more of the bully on the playground, seemingly, that could force certain outcomes to come about that you may never have imagined before. You know, when you start thinking, gosh, how do you get to 38 states? I don't think it becomes so remote anymore.
I want to add something here. If one looks at a January 23rd article published by CNBC.com, they talk about Trump is open to it, meaning Trump is open to a possible third term. It says, over the course of his political career, Trump has repeatedly hinted at his willingness to serve more than 2 terms in office. This is his quote. I suspect I won't be running again unless you say, he's so good, we've got to figure something else out. Trump reportedly mused to House Republicans during a private meeting in November, shortly after his electoral victory over Democratic former Vice President Kamala Harris. So it just tells me that there are hints of this that we might see blossom in the future and should not be surprised.
Indeed. Indeed.
And should not be surprised at how this is going about. You know, there's a couple of ways also that he could do this without a constitutional amendment, and I think we ought to talk about those.
Okay, I'm all ears.
One is the constitutional amendment says he cannot be elected president for more than 2 terms, elected president. So one theory out there is that he would run again as vice president to perhaps J.D. Vance or some other minion that he would put up to run for president, with the understanding as soon as that person was elected, they would resign and the vice president then would become president of the United States. That's a way Trump could have a third term without going through the constitutional amendment process. What do you think about that?
I think it is very strategic, and it is maybe, you know, par for the course for those seeking to subvert the rules, because this would absolutely be, you know, a method of kind of gaming the system that, you know, maybe most did not think of.
Oh, and we're not used to gaming the system, are we?
Right. Or maybe the problem is that, you know, that some people have been able to outgame the system, much to the chagrin of others. And so, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game. And so this would absolutely be one of those, you know, we should probably hate the game because the player is playing it very sophisticated game.
There was an article not too long ago in Politico that said the campaign slogan writes itself, "Vote Vance to make Trump president again."
There you go. And you know what? There may be those who are completely, completely fine with that. It at least it appears from the results of November that there clearly is a broad enough, wide enough swath of the voting populace, because there was still a considerable number of people who did not vote at all. But for those who did cast votes, they are perfectly fine with the fact that, you know, the President Trump needed a new vice president. There's a really good reason why the old vice president wasn't his running mate again, but they were fine with that. And I think that under these circumstances, you probably you'll find many, many people who have no issue with that whatsoever, and they will absolutely invite it.
You know, the other aspect of this is that President Trump is not above ignoring the law, right?
Well, as we have seen.
You know, we've talked about certain kinds of executive orders and certain kinds of actions that he's just not above it. So there's another theory that he could just say, "Hey, I'm running for a third term." People would be out there crying and say, "You can't do that. You can't do that. The Constitution says you can't do that." And he goes, "I'm running for a third term. I'm president. I have the military. I can't do anything illegal," says the Supreme Court. So I'm going to go ahead and do it. And screw you all.
Right. And rules don't apply to me, by the way. Rules don't apply to me. And that also, I think, is a very probable option and outcome. I think that this is someone who's threatened to use military force in the past to achieve certain outcomes. And thankfully, there have been, you know, enough individuals standing in the gap to help avert that. But I don't know that we can count on that being the case going forward. And it's entirely possible that we may, you know, in the next few years or so, we may see kind of the first time when the U.S. military has been turned on its own people.
Yeah.
That is extremely unsettling, but it's also not outside the realm of possibility. And, you know, for anyone who believes that, you know, in their corner of the world, they will or may or and possibly can remain unaffected, I would just encourage them to please take their head out the sand.
So in summary, a constitutional amendment being passed by Congress is unlikely at this point. However, we don't know. There's within the presidential term of Donald Trump, there is a midterm election that could give the Republicans a supermajority, which could allow it to be passed. Correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
At the same time, the same election could flip.
And make it impossible for that to happen.
Indeed.
So the backup position from the Trumpites position would be to perhaps get a constitutional convention called by the states and muster pressure on states to do that. Then pressure on states to pass it. That's a possibility. That's a real possibility. And we shouldn't rule that out. And a constitutional convention would not be limited to just the presidential succession and presidential terms, but could open up all kinds of changes in the Constitution.
We call that a slippery slope.
That is a big time slippery slope. So if that doesn't work, then we can maybe find loopholes in the 25th Amendment with the way it's worded, the Trump people would think, and perhaps have him run as vice president to then move up to president. Or the last option would be just say, screw it all. I'm president. I can do whatever I want. And I'm running for a third term. Is that basically summarize where we are with all this?
Indeed, it does. What something that just flashed in my mind that's pretty comedic is what happens if, you know, that option of running as vice president with the handshake or agreement that the president on paper would resign actually doesn't resign.
I'd hate to be that person. I would say that person would put themselves in jeopardy.
Indeed, but this is like mob boss like behavior. But yeah,
well, it all is. It all is. It's this is the law, and you and I have explained the procedures. This is the law. How do we get around it? That's the whole mentality. Yes. How do we either ignore it or get around it or find a loophole in it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it is. That's the world that we live in right now.
Indeed.
Well, I think that does it with constitutional amendment. What do you think?
It does. And hopefully our audience really appreciates our explanation here because it's an opportunity to learn a lot and to be able to engage these conversations more thoughtfully because they're going to keep coming up and we're going to see them again and again.
And be prepared.
And when we do, it's so important to be armed with good practical information about how process works because the flip side is that we can be overtaken with anxiety and supposition because we don't know and we don't understand. So understanding, I think, is key and important.
I have all of that anxiety, and I do understand. So I can't imagine the anxiety level if I didn't understand.
Indeed.
be even higher. How do people find us if they want to hear more of our analysis of legal processes?
Well, we've got some great things still coming on tap, and certainly
we do.
We have already built a great library, I think, of wonderful topics. So we're going to invite you to please check us out. Don't just listen, but we're asking that you submit an evaluation and then you subscribe to Next Witness, Please. Where can we be found? Well, we are free on Audible and free on Amazon Music. So check us out on those platforms. But you know what? You should start with perhaps our biggest supporter, which is NPR, National Public Radio, who is amazingly supportive of this important civic work that we do. And if you are also a podcast lover, then you probably know that there are lots of places where you can get your favorite podcasts. And so you can find us on Apple, on Spotify, and other platforms where you find your favorite podcasts. So just to recap, we are free on Audible, free on Amazon, Apple and Spotify, and among all, and at the top is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's the NPR podcast directory, to be absolutely technically accurate, but you can just go to NPR and look at podcasts and you'll find us. No problem. If you have any questions about our podcast or you'd like to suggest a topic for us to cover in the future, reach out to me by email. You can do that at Hodson, hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, all lowercase, @ohio.edu. Next Witness, Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back. There is so much going on in the legal world for us to understand. We'll be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and the legal process. And I think Judge Gale would say, people don't trust what they don't understand. So we're trying to build your understanding so we can build your trust in the rule of law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.